necessary aggravations by the end of this week. The Palestinian warning came in the wake of the Qataris informing the United Nations and officials in the Biden administration that such a step provokes the Palestinians and pushes towards an explosive situation. The Palestinian message precedes the Egyptians sending invitations to 19 resistance factions to attend high-level meetings in Cairo in the presence of President Mahmoud Abbas to open dialogue between the Palestinian Authority and the resistance factions in Gaza. For the first time, Cairo invites many resistance factions other than Hamas and the Islamic Jihad to attend the dialogues at the request of Hamas, given that all the factions were equal partners in the last battle, despite objections from certain members of the Fatah movement. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance factions stressed in a joint statement the need to stop all provocations practiced by the occupation in occupied Al-Quds and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, to stop the aggression against the Palestinian people, to speed up reconstruction, and to lift the siege on Gaza. In the meantime, commander of the southern region in the Israeli occupation forces, Eliezer Toledano, announced that the army was preparing to resume fighting with Hamas again, because apparently what Israel did in the last round of terrorism against Gaza was not enough, adding that the next operation will not end without changing the security reality in Gaza. Adding salt to the injury, right-wing Zionist Jewish groups announced last week that they would redo the flag march they usually did on what they call Jerusalem Day next Thursday, after their provocative march this year was canceled due to heightened tensions. The march is expected to begin at 7 p.m. Al-Quds time on Thursday, June 10, and head through multiple routes towards the Western Wall near the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israeli occupation forces have reportedly approved the march. However, Palestinian natives have warned that this provocation will only lead to renewed clashes. Welcome to the Middle East stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As Palestinian factions prepare for dialogue in Cairo, the invasive scene in Gaza is becoming more complex, foretelling the possibility of another confrontation again in light of Israel's insistence on pushing the Gaza Strip. While all border crossings have been closed since the last aggression, Israel's obstruction of the Qatari fund into Gaza poured fuel on the fire, calling for a strongly worded message from the resistance, in which it affirmed that unless the funds are released by this week, it will be concerned with taking an important decision regarding the cessation of hostilities. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Julia Qasim, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Julia. Now, the resistance factions have informed the Egyptian and the international mediators that the continuous Israeli provocations toward Gaza and its besieged citizens who are to benefit from the Qatari fund or the grant, which Israel is blocking, which more than 100,000 Palestinian families will be benefiting from, it will directly mean a push towards an escalation of the situation in Gaza. Do you think that Gaza can handle another round of the Israeli terrorism and violence?
Better question is, can the Zionist entity handle another round of Gazan resistance? And the answer is, it knows that it can't. The ceasefire that was called for was a one-sided ceasefire, with the Zionist entity basically begging for it, especially after basically receiving news that not only was the Zionist entity brought to its knees when the Gazan resistance barely even exhausted their old stockpiles. But the whole resistance axis was prepared to also come in on the condition that Gaza would, of course, invite them. But Israel was just definitely not ready to face like another round of rockets, including 300 rockets total fired at once, 150 alone at Tel Aviv. So it was terrified then. It's still terrified now. It's trying to even put pressure to make sure that the resistance doesn't respond to its provocations. And its provocations that we've seen in the last few weeks, including the attacks on Al-Aqsa, the harassment of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. It's trying to kind of push the envelope as far as to make itself look scary, but immediately stops once it realizes that the repercussions in another round of fighting could lead to its demise, most certainly. They released Muhammad and Munna al-Kurd within hours of detaining them, and this is out of fear. 2 days ago, the Zionist entity canceled the military parade, and today they were too afraid to even wave their occupier flags in Jerusalem. So I would say that it is actually Israel that is put on the defensive this time.
Well, Julia, the resistance did vow that if the provocations do not stop by the end of this week, it will take an important decision by stopping or maybe just throwing away any kind of cessation of a fire or ceasefire. Mind you now, last week, Isaac Herzog was elected as the new president of the Zionist entity, and it seems that a new government is on the verge of being formed in the Israeli entity. But is it wise for Netanyahu at this moment to get involved in another round of aggression, which he sees the best, maybe the best boat out of this chaos inside of the Israeli regime?
Yeah, so Netanyahu's regime, Netanyahu and his party specifically, the far-right coalition he attempted to assemble up and push the deal of the century, which failed, the provocations against Lebanon, the attacks on resistance factions in Syria and on the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq 2 years ago, those have backfired. So Netanyahu right now in an attempt to shore up legitimacy, especially in the face of a multi-factional coalition of the Zionist entity that's attempting to kind of save face of the entity itself in face of, in light of Netanyahu's repeated failures. He's just trying to kind of salvage the little legitimacy that he is attempting to have. You know, he has corruption charges, the collapse of his government and his coalition. So what this is essentially is that, like I said, he knows that he can't really stand a chance militarily or even politically at this point. But it's an sad attempt to save face, essentially.
Well, during all these developments, we did see an invitation by Cairo for 19 Palestinian factions from the Gaza Strip that took part in the last battle against Gaza. This meeting is supposed to happen in Cairo in the presence of the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. And as I told you, most of the factions are invited for the first time in such high-level talks. But some Fatah movement members were vocal about their rejection of such an invitation, meaning a wide-scope invitation allowing all the Palestinian factions in. Is there a chance that these talks might actually be fruitful, given that Abbas still refuses to acknowledge the very last election that happened when Hamas won the elections?
The whole context of the talks reflects the context of the Palestinian resistance and the force on the ground, essentially. So the Palestinian resistance is more united than ever. They have been more united in the face of struggle and in the face of the siege that has last occurred. And it is also clearer than ever that the PA, which is essentially the neo-colonial force, containing Gaza, containing the West Bank at the direction of the occupation, which has collaborated against the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people to the benefit of the Zionist occupation, their legitimacy has completely collapsed. And they, just as Israel is more insecure than ever, so is the Palestinian Authority. As a neo-colonial police force that is essentially losing its legitimacy and authority. So, see, in the face of a Palestinian resistance that is essentially more unified than ever, it's just clear that these recent remarks and this bitterness by Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority reaffirms its lack of stance at all with the Palestinian resistance and with the Palestinian people. And this is something that's consistent.
Well, in the meantime, we had the commander of the southern region of the Israeli occupation forces, his name is Eleazar Toledano, announced that Israel is preparing to resume the fighting against Gaza, and they have in mind that this time they will not allow the security of the resistance to remain intact inside of the Gaza Strip. So we're talking about massacres here, a continuation of the incremental genocide by the Israeli entity against the people of Gaza. Sayyid Nasrallah was very clear. The Secretary General of Hezbollah said in his last appearance that there will be a regional war if the Zionist entity provokes the Palestinian people, whether it is in Gaza or in Al-Quds, but he was very clear, Al-Quds equals a regional war. Do you think that we are on the verge of the biggest war that this region has ever seen?
You know, I think that I'm positive that the Zionist entities talks right now, you know, it wanting to be provocative, it's just empty talk, essentially, because it understands, and the resistance has made it clear, Yahya Sinwar of Hamas and Sayyid Nasrallah have made it very, very clear, along with other, you know, leaders of the resistance axis, that there is full support and coordination from all members of the resistance axis to the resistance factions in Gaza, and this will be furthered into a complete campaign to liberate Palestine and Al-Aqsa should Israel fall completely through on its provocations and wage another attack of the same nature. We're to see that becoming more clear by the end of this week. But it is definitely clear that the Zionist entity, though they do not want to have any kind of provocations that's going to make them instantly lose, they still kind of want to save face. I mean, the entity begged for a ceasefire just because people, settlers, were tired of running to bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, it's just a balance that the Zionist entity is trying to have of saving face and trying to make itself look like it has any legitimacy left, which it doesn't, can ensure any protection of its illegal settlers, which it can't. And the resistance, which is on the verge of victory right now, we can envision victory as Lebanese, as Palestinians, and there is full preparation to achieve it and attain it if the Zionist entity makes any stupid moves.
Well, it's going to be a very decisive week indeed. Thank you very much, Julia Qasim from Beirut, political commentator, talking to us about the prospects of another ignition of fire between the Palestinians and the Israeli Zionist entity. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen being part of the equation of Al-Quds.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Now, leader of the Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, announced that the Yemeni people are part of the deterrence equation established by regional resistance in linking the Israeli threat towards Al-Quds to a regional war. Sayyid Houthi criticized the Saudi and the Emirati media and their shameful handling of the recent Israeli aggression on Gaza while praising the Iranian position. Sayyid Houthi also identified three steps to attain peace in Yemen: stopping the Saudi aggression, lifting the siege, and ending the occupation. More in this following report.
Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik Badruddin al-Houthi, stressed last week that the Yemenis are part of the Al-Quds formula, as announced by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, and will be present effectively in the battle against the Zionist entity. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah consecrated, during his speech on the 21st anniversary of Resistance and Liberation Day, a new formula: if Israel tampers with Al-Quds, it will face a regional war. Sayyid Houthi indicated that Hezbollah and the Palestinian resistance were not supported by any Arab or Muslim state except Iran and Syria, highlighting the importance of the recent victory in Gaza. Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement then urged Muslim countries to join forces against Israel in order to expel its regime from the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds and to completely boycott the Tel Aviv regime. The Yemeni leader noted that the pro-Israeli traitors accused the resistance forces of being Iran's proxy groups, adding that the Takfiri war launched against them only serves the U.S. and Israel. Meanwhile, Sayyid Houthi stressed that the peaceful solution in Yemen can be reached when the Saudi-led coalition halts its war and blockade on the Yemenis, adding that the Yemeni nation will not give up its right to freedom, independence, and dignity, and will not abandon its struggle against American and Israeli plots. Furthermore, in an indication of positive developments in the ongoing negotiations to stop the Saudi war in Yemen, an Omani delegation arrived in the Yemeni capital Sana'a on a visit, the first of its kind in years, on Saturday. The delegation was accompanied to Sana'a Airport by the spokesman of the Ansarullah Resistance Movement and the head of the Sana'a negotiating delegation, Muhammad Abdussalam, on a plane belonging to the Omani Royal Air Force. Upon his arrival at Sana'a Airport, Abdussalam said that the delegation of the Royal Office came to discuss the situation in Yemen on the basis of the principle of common interests. Abdussalam noted that the aim of the Omani delegation's visit was to work on advancing the humanitarian situation as well as the peace process.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Sana'a is Mr. Muhammad Ashami, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Muhammad. Now, Sayyid Abdulmalik al-Houthi made it clear that Yemen will be part of the deterrence equation established by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in linking the Israeli threat towards al-Quds to a regional war. Are we going to see Yemeni ballistic missiles landing in the occupied territories of Palestine against the Zionist entity?
Israeli occupation forces take those warnings lightly from both Sayyid Nasrallah and Sayyid al-Houthi, and I believe we may see defense operations and ballistic missiles, drone attacks as well, following the Zionist forces from Yemen. The remarks by both leaders reflect a higher, improved level of coordination amongst the resistance access, and affirms that Yemen today is a strong, integral part of this new equation.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, Sayyid Abdulmalik went on to say that the Saudi and the Emirati media outlets took up a hostile position towards the Palestinian people, and especially the Palestinian resistance factions inside of Gaza who were were bombing retaliatory rocket attacks against the Israeli entity, proving their allegiance to the Zionist regime, sadly. I'm talking about the media in the Persian Arab Gulf states. This strategy was surely part of the normalization process which these states have started with the Zionist entity last year. Do you think this strategy was enough maybe to subdue their citizens into accepting ties with this warmongering entity that committed massacres against the Palestinian people?
We all noticed that both Saudi and the Emirati exerted a very high level of media effort trying to spread their propaganda against Iran and the Palestinian resistance, while covering up also at the same time for the war crimes committed by the Israeli occupation. This in itself can be taken as an indication that there are many people inside Saudi and the UAE who do not probably buy into this narration, Zionist Arab version of the narration, especially following the resistance latest victory in Gaza, and the increasing awareness that Iran has been actually at the heart of Palestine, supporting and assisting its resistance. So no, I don't think that people are buying that narration.
Well, something very important happened on Saturday is the landing of Omani plane, on board of which is Omani committee alongside the spokesperson of the Ansarullah movement, which breaks way for serious negotiations and dialogue to end the Saudi war on Yemen. What are your views on this?
The Omani delegation that has just arrived with the head of the national delegation, Muhammad Abdussalam, they arrived a couple of days back, and they said that they are continuing the discussions they had started in Muscat. Muhammad Abdussalam did not comment much about it, but he implied in his brief comments that they will be discussing first the humanitarian issues, and hopefully if the coalition is serious about it this time, then this may lead to opening other discussions leading to complete ceasefire and bringing back peace to Yemen. We hope that they are serious about it this time.
Sayyid Abdulmalik al-Houthi did identify three very important steps for peace in Yemen, which includes stopping the Saudi aggression, lifting the blockade and the siege of the Yemeni population, and ending the occupation. He means the Saudi and the Emirati occupation of Yemeni land. Mohammed bin Salman has turned several opportunities down that would have made this halting of an aggression at least somewhat easier than bringing it to this level right now. What is Mohammed bin Salman really counting on that would secure him a political gain, which for the past 6 years he had never been able to attain on the field, in the battlefield of Yemen?
Well, let's agree on one thing first. Saudi has lost its military war in Yemen. On the other hand, Yemen counterattacks are becoming more severe, more frequent, and more painful. So what are the options for Saudi? Causing maximum humanitarian damage to 30 million people. And that's what they are trying to do. They use that to negotiate military terms. For example, they say, okay, we will release you some of the fuel vessels provided you stop advancing towards Marib, which is ridiculous. Sayed Abdul Malik met the UN representative, Mr. Martin Griffith, last Sunday, and he warned him against continuing to exploit the humanitarian issues of the people. And he affirmed that this will not get them any gains, political gains. And he said that if they continue this, it only means that they are not serious about bringing back peace to Yemen or ending their war.
Well, in the meantime, the Yemeni armed forces are making great advances in the northern governorate of Ma'rib, while also simultaneously achieving groundbreaking reconciliation with many Yemeni tribes in that governorate, which means that less fighting is ahead, which means more reconciliation is to be viewed in the future. How significant do you think the liberation of Ma'rib will be in changing the balance of power in this ongoing Saudi onslaught of Yemen?
It's very important. The liberation of Marib can significantly alter the whole political terrain and most probably will determine the subsequent outcomes for years to come. The governorate is oil rich and it has been used as stronghold by the coalition for their military operations for the past 6-7 years. Losing it means losing a major source of finance. It also means that the forces that are there will be outcasted. There are several mix of mercenary groups that are fighting alongside the coalition, including Al-Qaeda. And if they are outcasted from Marib, they will not have an alternative place to be in. If they go towards the south, they are not welcomed. And that will further complicate the problems that the coalition is already facing with its different factions there.
What would you think that a liberation of Ma'rib would actually complicate the dialogue, the peace process in Yemen?
No, actually it will foster it, I think, because they are trying to protect Ma'rib with every level of strength that they have. I think it will be a very good gain because they will not have any more strong points to negotiate on.
Well, the very important issue in this negotiation that is to be taking place, if it is already taking place, is the humanitarian status inside of Yemen. As you mentioned before, there are more than 13 million civilians in Yemen on the verge of complete starvation. What do you think will be the biggest challenge for Ansarullah in the event of a ceasefire?
In the event of a ceasefire, there will be a challenge of inclusion. Let's say the goal would be to include all the political parties and resume the peace process again.
Mm-hmm.
It is that peace process, if you remember, before this military intervention by Saudi, that was going under UN supervision, and almost the previous UN representative Jamal bin Omar said, Yemenis were about to reach a historical consensus, a peaceful agreement, when this military action started on March 2015. So if they stop their aggression, I think it would be less of a challenge to resume that peace process and include everybody, but in terms of level terms, not with domination coming from Saudi or the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammed Shami, political commentator who joined us from Sana'a to talk about the prospects of talks, negotiations, and complete cessation of a war against Yemen, and also the inclusion of Yemen in the Al-Quds versus a regional war equation set up by the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Shami, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime obliterated whole families in their homes during its 11-day attack on Gaza in May, some removed entirely from the population registry. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Electronic Intifada. This article is published under the heading Palestine, Families Obliterated, Lives Destroyed. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime obliterated whole families in their homes during its 11-day attack on Gaza in May, some removed entirely from the population registry. Parents and children, cousins and siblings, grandparents, aunts and uncles were killed together when the Zionist regime warplanes bombed residential buildings and private homes without warning the families inside. Killing multiple members of multiple families has become the hallmark of Israeli wars on Gaza and has led to Palestinians there resurrecting some grisly traditions. People in Gaza have been reviving an old tradition in which some families exchange their kids so that, in case some get bombed, the others would live. Twitter user Muhammad Qudai wrote amidst the assault, "My family is spread out over three houses in three different locations, as if they're trying to avert a massacre." Maha Muhammad Abu Hatab was visiting her brother Ala Muhammad Abu Hatab house for aid on May 15th, when it was hit with three Israeli regime missiles, according to Al Mizan, a human rights group in Gaza. There was no warning. "My wife and kids went to share the aid blessings with her brother. They got dressed and went to her brother's house. Innocent children." Muhammad Al-Hadidi said of his wife Maha and their children, "The attack at 1:30 in the morning killed Maha and her children, as well as Allah's wife and children. Maha was 34. Her children, Sohaib al-Hadidi, was 12. Abd al-Rahman, 7, and their brother, Osma, was 5. Their 10-year-old brother, Yahya, was later also confirmed killed in the attack. Their cousins, Yusuf Abu Hatab, 10, and his siblings, 9-year-old Bilal, 7-year-old Maryam, and 5-year-old Yaman, were all killed in the strike. Their mother, Yasmin Muhammad Abu Hatab, 30, was also killed. Only Muhammad al-Hadidi's 5-month-old son, Omar, survived the Israeli regime's blast. In the early hours of May 13th, the Zionist regime warplanes dropped 20 missiles on a densely populated neighborhood in Beit Lahia. The blast killed 6 members of the al-Tanani family. Rafat Muhammad Ismail al-Tanani and his wife, Raya Fatih al-Tanani, were killed along with 4 of their children. Ismail 7, Amir 6, Adam 4, and their 2-year-old brother Ahmad were all killed in the attack, according to Defense for Children International Palestine. A 7th member of the family is still missing, DCIP reported. The same blast killed the wife and husband who owned the building where Al-Thanani family was renting their home, Abd al-Rahim Muhammad al-Madun, 63, and his wife, Halima Ali Abu Sharah, 66. Stores, lawyers' offices, an education center, and 9 houses were completely destroyed in the Zionist regime's strikes. Nearby streets were also destroyed, along with water pipes and sewer systems, as well as telephone lines and electricity. An Israeli regime missile hit a 2-story residential building in Al-Manar neighborhood in Gaza City on the second day of the Zionist regime's onslaught, killing Eyad Fathi Sharir, 44, and his 40-year-old wife, Layali Taha Sharir. Their 15-year-old daughter, Lina Eyad Sharir, were also killed in the blast. After being hospitalized with severe burns after the strike, their 2-year-old daughter, Mina Eyad Sharir, nearly survived the Zionist regime's airstrikes on May 11th. But the toddler died from her wounds a week later on May 18th, joining her parents and sister in death. On May 14th, the Israeli regime's warplanes dropped 2 missiles on agricultural land near a home in Beit Lahia, killing 3 children and their mother, Islam Muhammad al-Attar, 8, his 6-year-old sister, Amira Muhammad al-Attar, and their infant brother, Muhammad Zainuddin Muhammad al-Attar, were all killed in the attack. Their 26-year-old mother, Lamia, was also killed. The family was on the ground floor of their home, according to DCIP, and a concrete pillar fell on them. Their bodies were pulled from under the rubble hours after the attack. Lamia's father, a civil defense officer, told Amnesty International that he arrived at the scene with an ambulance and a rescue team after a relative called and told him of the attack. Hassan al-Attar told Amnesty International, "I went to the 3-story house where 20 people live, and I tried to find someone, but I couldn't. Then the rescue team came to help and eventually found my daughter, a mother of 3, with her children, one of them a baby, under one of the pillars of the house. They were all dead. It seems the rest of the residents managed to escape the bombing and reach the hospital. I was shocked." In the early hours of May 12th, the Zionist regime warplanes fired 2 missiles at a 5-story apartment building in Tal al-Hawa neighborhood in Gaza City, killing at least 5 Palestinians. Reem Saad Kamel Saad, 31, a pregnant mother, was killed alongside her 5-year-old son, Zaid Muhammad al-Talbani. Her toddler, Maryam Muhammad al-Talbani's remains were only found the day a ceasefire was declared. The Israeli regime attack on Maryam's home was so huge and violent, and she was so tiny, that it took 9 full days to find her body under the rubble. Miranda Cleland of DCIP wrote on Twitter, "The children's father, Muhammad Odeh al-Talbani, was reportedly injured. 3 others were killed in the same attack, while Abdul Karim Isi, 40, Muhammad Hassan al-Awaji, 34, and Hala Hussein al-Rafi, who was 13 years old. Iyad Abdul Fattah Salha was home with his wife and toddler one afternoon when an Israeli regime missile struck on May 19th, killing them all. Salha was disabled and used a wheelchair. His wife, Amani Yusuf Imawish, was 8 months pregnant. Their toddler daughter, Nagam Iyad Salha, was killed along with them. It remains unclear whether the missile was fired by an Israeli warplane or a weaponized aerial drone, according to DCIP.
Nguyen Diem, a pro-American, became president of South Vietnam in 1955 and, with the assistance of the U.S., began to arrest anyone suspected of being a member of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition. The U.S. then gradually increased its troop deployment to the country, fearing that communism would soon spread across the region. In 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident gave the U.S. government an excuse to justify a war on Vietnam. An intruding U.S. destroyer clashed with North Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats in August of that year. In an ensuing sea battle, one U.S. aircraft and three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Also, four North Vietnamese soldiers were killed. As a result, the U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. After a bloody and protracted war, a truce was struck in 1973, ending direct U.S. involvement and completing the evacuation of American forces, which had grown to 500,000. The war claimed the lives of 58,000 Americans and 4 million Vietnamese. It impacted 700,000 American veterans, cost the U.S. more than $100 billion, and tarnished the country's image and morale at home. However, the true narrative behind the Vietnam War was revealed after then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned a secret history based on classified papers, the Pentagon Papers, in 1967. He formed a research team to assemble and analyze Defense Department decision-making dating back to 1945. An analyst on the research, Daniel Ellsberg, eventually disclosed portions of the report to the New York Times, which was published in 1971. The papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War, with coastal raids on North Vietnam and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were reported in the mainstream media. The Pentagon Papers are an important record of the United States' first defeat in a war. To this day, the United States' failures in the Vietnam War, as well as its atrocities in terms of civilian casualties and the deployment of chemical weapons, have stained America's reputation at home and abroad. After years of battle and endless resources poured into the U.S. military to win the Battle of Vietnam, the result saw the U.S. lose the war and has since seen it lose many more, all from the same common denominator. Daniel Ellsberg has compared the Forever Wars with the Vietnam War. He says both conflicts are characterized by lies and deceptions fed to the American people and the rest of the world about the inflated and false achievements of the wars. America's Forever Wars have lasted for two decades and cost $6.4 trillion, resulting in calls on Washington to reassess its policies, as there are doubts whether the benefits to U.S. security outweigh the costs. The U.S. troops have also conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. The U.S. military has conducted so-called counter-terror activities in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. Moreover, Washington owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. The ongoing war on terror has taken a heavy toll as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and over 335,000 civilians have lost their lives.
Oh, definitely, and they're not gonna learn that lesson as long as the U.S. remains an imperialist country. And the reality is that every war, from Korea to Vietnam, and even if we went back further in history to the wars against the Native Americans, the people are always demonized in the targeted countries. Those are the targets of the war machine. And today we have the same thing going on. Cuba is demonized, Venezuela is demonized, North Korea, Iran.
After spending trillions of dollars and ruining the lives of millions during the Forever Wars, Washington has failed to win a single war as yet. The Vietnam War and the Forever Wars share the same characteristics, the lies and deceptions fed to the American people and the rest of the world about the war's exaggerated and false achievements. It seems Washington doesn't want to learn its lesson and stop fighting lost battles. Since 2010, Israel has been linked to at least a dozen of attacks on Iran's nuclear program. These operations were aimed at disrupting Iran's progress in the field of peaceful nuclear technology through acts of sabotage targeting Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Between 2010 and 2012, four Iranian scientists, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Dariush Rezai Nejad, and Mohsen Ahmadi Roshan were assassinated, while another scientist named Fereydoun Abbasi was wounded in an attempted murder. Also, in November 2020, another top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated in a roadside attack. Iran blamed the killing on Israel and condemned it as terrorism. Tehran also slammed world bodies for their silence on the acts of terrorism targeting the Iranian nation and its elite personalities. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv neither confirmed nor denied its involvement in the attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and scientists. However, last week, Israel's Channel 12 aired an eye-opening interview with former Mossad chief Yossi Cohen, who led the spy agency for more than 5 years. Yossi Cohen hinted at Tel Aviv's involvement in two explosions over the last year at Natanz nuclear facility, as well as the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He also shamelessly threatened Iranian scientists involved in the country's nuclear program with death. That's while Israel has always pursued a policy of deliberate ambiguity over its nuclear capabilities, as well as the issue of targeted killings and airstrikes. Iran's mission to the United Nations slammed Israeli lawlessness, saying that Cohen's comments reflect Tel Aviv's long-standing strategy of criminal sabotage against Tehran. Cohen's interview is aired as talks to revive Iran's nuclear deal are about to resume amid hints of progress. The Israeli regime has been the nuclear deal's strongest opponent, although the United Nations, the European Union, and others have hailed it as a diplomatic success. Iran has repeatedly complained about Israel's attacks, with Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, warning as recently as Thursday that the incidents not only will be responded to decisively, but also certainly leave no option for Iran but to reconsider its transparency measures and cooperation policy. Gharibabadi also slammed IAEA's silence in the face of terrorist attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of scientists. Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of the weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several Iranian nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. That's while the Israeli regime itself has, under constant U.S. protection, avoided joining the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and is now in possession of hundreds of nuclear warheads and other non-conventional weaponry.
Israel is saying that it claims a right to commit any act of murder or sabotage against Iran that it wishes. But what Israel doesn't realize, and what Israel's American backers don't realize, is that that these kinds of actions virtually force Iran or other such countries to take equivalent measures against Israel and the U.S. So they're opening up a Pandora's box by opening the international scene to all kinds of acts of murder, sabotage, revenge, etc. And every country will claim the right to do so, and they'll cite Israel as an example. So Israel is playing with fire here and is going to get burned because equivalent measures will be taken against it.
The revelation of outgoing Israel's spy agency that Israel was behind recent attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and its top scientists shows that it has no respect for the law That's while Israel has followed a deliberate policy of ambiguity for years. It seems favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as Washington's invariable support for the regime, has given it the green light to break international law. Isn't it high time for the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes?
When the novel coronavirus began to spread around the globe in early 2020, many were pinning their hopes on herd immunity as a means to end the pandemic, a slow process in which a majority of the population becomes immune to the disease, making the transmission harder. But scientists began their studies on the contagion from early on to understand the virus and produce a vaccine. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine became the first to obtain the World Health Organization's approval for emergency use, offering the world a glimmer of hope in the fight against the deadly respiratory disease. Months later, however, the world is still struggling with the pandemic and its impact on the lives of its 8 billion inhabitants. While new cases and deaths have sharply fallen in richer nations, poorer countries, including those in Africa, are witnessing soaring infections and fatalities. Many observers, including the WHO, attribute that to vaccine inequity.
6 months since the first vaccines were administered, high-income countries have administered almost 44% of the world's doses. Low-income countries have administered just 0.4%. The most frustrating thing about this statistic is that it hasn't changed in months. Inequitable vaccination is a threat to all nations, not just those with the fewest vaccines.
Well, I think that it's never too late if you're talking about saving lives around the world, but I believe that it's absolutely true that we should have approached this pandemic as a global problem from the very beginning. If all of the countries had teamed together and distributed the vaccines across the globe early on, I think we would have seen much, much less death and devastation due to this pandemic. So, yes, it's wonderful that some countries are stepping up now and offering doses of the vaccine, but absolutely this should have been done, 12, 13, 15 months ago.
Human rights groups and charities are calling on the world's richest nations to do more to help bring the pandemic to an end. Ahead of his visit to the United Kingdom to attend the G7 summit, U.S. President Joe Biden unveiled America's plan to help poorer nations fight the COVID-19 outbreak.
The United States will purchase 500 million doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to donate to nearly 100 nations that are in dire need in the fight against this pandemic.
Other G7 nations have also pledged to chip in to meet the group's 1 billion dose target. In the meantime, health and anti-poverty campaigners say while the G7's pledge is a step in the right direction, it falls short of the number of doses needed to win the battle against the pandemic. Charity organization Oxfam said, to end the COVID crisis, the world needs 11 billion doses of vaccines. It also called on the G7 to support a push for a waiver on the intellectual property rights behind the vaccines, a move that would give other nations better access to the much-needed jabs.
I think that the amount of doses being offered are absolutely a drop in the bucket, and we've seen certainly here in the United States that the country was very, very cautious about releasing doses, hoarding doses, really, of the vaccine for a very long time, partly with a notion of protecting the local residents first before sharing vaccines with the rest of the world. And I do think this is a very short-sighted approach because the vaccine does not know boundaries. The vaccine does not know national borders. And so as we've seen with the way the pandemic spread, you have to vaccinate the entire world in order to protect everyone in the world. So the idea of reserving doses just for your own population, I think, is very, very short-sighted on the part of all of these countries.
According to Johns Hopkins University, over 2.2 billion doses have been administered worldwide as of June 12, 2020. At this rate, several countries are expected to fall short of the WHO's target of inoculating 10% of their population against the infectious disease by September.
The diplomatic relationship between the United States and its geopolitical rival Russia is severely strained. A series of tit-for-tat actions has left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such actions date back to the 1980s, but they have escalated over the past years. In 2016, America expelled dozens of Russian intelligence operatives. In response, Moscow expelled more than 700 American diplomats the following year. Later, the U.S. ordered the closure of Russian consulates in San Francisco and Seattle. Russia ordered the closure of the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg in 2018. Earlier this year, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden announced sanctions on Moscow and expelled 10 Russian diplomats. In response, the Russian Federation announced that it was sanctioning several high-ranking U.S. officials and expelling 10 American diplomats. Right now, the U.S. and Russia have withdrawn their ambassadors from their respective capitals. Such tit-for-tat actions have resulted in a dramatic reduction in the diplomatic footprint in Moscow and Washington, making it very difficult to even conduct basic diplomacy. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two superpowers around the world. Ties between the United States and Russia are once again under the spotlight as the U.S. president and his Russian counterpart are scheduled to meet next week. During their upcoming meeting, the American president is expected to raise very touchy issues with the Russian leader. Those sore points include allegations of Russian interference in American elections and Moscow's involvement in Ukraine, where Russia and the West have been locked in a tug of war for years. This week, Biden had tough words for Russia just days ahead of the high-stakes Geneva meeting. He warned that Moscow faces robust and meaningful consequences if it engages in, quote, harmful activities.
What the United States is trying to do is to act like they are tough, it's for domestic consumption. You know, what goes on between the two leaders, what exactly Biden would be afraid of, we don't know. What worries United States the most is the whole situation with Ukraine, because United States put all their bets and all their sort of cards and all their money into Ukraine.
Before Biden sits down for talks with Putin in Geneva, he is consulting with European leaders at the G7 in Britain and the NATO summit in Brussels. Biden is expected to try to build pressure on the Russian Federation. America views Russia as the second most serious threat after China. While former U.S. President Donald Trump tried to avoid penalizing Russia on the world stage, in his first 100 days in office, Biden imposed new sanctions on Moscow and expelled nearly a dozen Russian diplomats from the U.S. Biden seems intent on taking a tougher line on Moscow. How will Putin react? The Russian leader is known for refusing to back down. The upcoming meeting in Geneva may not produce a breakthrough, but its outcome will probably provide a hint about the future course of relations between the two rivals.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Tens of thousands of people, including the leaders of the three parties on Spain's right, have rallied in Madrid to protest against the government's deeply divisive moves to pardon the 12 Catalan independence leaders convicted over their parts in the failed secession attempt almost 4 years ago. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sam Jones. The piece is titled Spanish Right Rallies Against Plans to Pardon Catalan Separatists. Tens of thousands of people, including the leaders of the three parties on Spain's right, have rallied in Madrid to protest against the government's deeply divisive moves to pardon the 12 Catalan independence leaders convicted over their parts in the failed secession attempt almost 4 years ago. The event on Sunday, 13th of June, held beneath the enormous Spanish flag in the capital's Plaza de Colón, came almost 2.5 years after a similar demonstration against the socialist government's handling of the Catalan independence crisis. The National Police Force said 25,000 people had attended the rally on Sunday, whilst local police put the figure at 126,000. Unlike the last protest, during which the heads of the Conservative People's Party and the centre-right Citizens Party posed for controversial photos alongside the leader of the far-right Vox Party, the leaders deliberately kept their distance from one another on Sunday. A recent national opinion poll for El Mundo found that 61% of the public did not agree with the pardons, while 29.5% backed them. The socialist-led coalition government of Pedro Sanchez will have the final say, but Spain's Supreme Court issued a non-binding report opposing the pardons last month, saying the jail sentences of between 9 and 13 years handed to 9 of the 12 independence leaders were appropriate, and noting those convicted had not shown the slightest evidence or faintest hint of contrition. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has acknowledged that pardons are unpopular with voters, but says they are the best way to end the political standoff and re-establish coexistence. Spanish society needs to move from a bad past to a better future, and that will require magnanimity, the Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said earlier this week. Both his willingness to consider the pardons and his emollient words have been seized on by his opponents, who accuse him of abandoning his previous anti-pardon stance and of selling out to the pro-independence Catalan Republican Left Party, on whom his minority government depends for support in Congress. We ask Pedro Sanchez to respect national unity, the Constitution, the equality of all Spaniards, and the law, the Popular Party leader Pablo Casado said before heading to the rally. We're asking Sanchez not to sell unity and national sovereignty for a handful of votes. Inés Arrimadas, who leads the Citizens Party, said Spaniards wanted justice and democracy. Mr. Sanchez ran in the election saying he wouldn't pardon the coup.